This is Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, a podcast and radio program presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. Most any contemporary musical style can trace its roots back to the blues. Time Signatures explores the blues and its musical connections with captivating interviews, lively discussions, and news from the world of the blues.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up and down these Michigan roads, yeah.
And now, here he is, your host, Jim Irvin.
Well, thank you so much, Parker, and welcome, everyone. I'm Jim Irvin, and this is Time Signatures. In the history of this program, I can honestly say today's guest truly does not need an introduction. If you know music, you know Tom Hambridge. His pedigree is not limited to the blues, though. In fact, he has said he never considered himself a genre guy. Quite possibly the nicest guy in the business, and I can't wait to get into our discussion. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my great honor to introduce you all to singer, songwriter, producer, and musician, Tom Hambridge. Tom, welcome to Time Signatures.
Oh, it's really nice to be here. Thanks, Jim.
It's a pleasure to have you, sir. Now, when I started recording episodes for Time Signatures nearly three calendar years ago, Tom, yours was among the first names that I received when I was compiling a list of people to interview. And honestly, I knew that you were an accomplished singer and songwriter and producer, but man, I had no clue how deep that well was until I started preparing for this interview. But you have to start somewhere. So do me a favor and take me back to the beginning. Where did your musical journey begin?
Wow. Well, I think, you know, for me, I'm kind of a lifer. You know, I've just been, you know, I played drums and I can never remember ever not being a drummer. So it wasn't like I picked up the drums when I was 16 or I started into music when I was in my 19 or I was playing the drums. My mom says, you know, basically when I was like 4 and 5 years old, just banging on stuff. And I had two older sisters and an older brother and I was kind of 5 years younger than the youngest one, you know what I mean? So they were already rocking and listening to music. And so music was around me. And I think probably, I don't know, it's just always been in me. So, you know, at an early age, I started trying to write songs. And I started playing in bands when I was really young with my older brother, who was 5 years older than me. So, you know, when he was like in seventh and eighth grade, he was in bands and I was the drummer. You know, he would say, well, my little brother plays, he's pretty good, you know. So I was always playing the drums. I got my first real drum kit when I was five and for Christmas. And that was a guy around the corner who was in a band, who was in high school. And I would sit in with his band on that drum kit.
Wow.
And he told my parents, he said, I'm going to college, but I'd sell it to him, you know, because, you know, so I got the kit for like $100 or something, you know, for my parents on my birthday and Christmas, I mean. And actually, it was for Christmas and my birthday because my birthday's right 5 days before Christmas. So my dad said, it's $100, man. This is going to be cover everything. Don't expect anything, you know, more than that, and, which was great. But anyway, so I guess early on, that's all I remember. I was in bands in junior high and high school. So I've just always kind of been doing what I've been doing. And so I don't know if that answers your question, but that's the early start, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Talk about that first paying gig in third grade. I was reading about that and I got to hear the story.
You know, that was a bar mitzvah and I didn't even know what it was, you know? But I know that, it was with a band, called, what were we called? I think we were called Extrapolation, but I was in one called Eternity Extrapolation. I was in so many bands, you know, and, growing up and I think I got $30, you know, and
wow, that was good money back then.
I remember that it was a 4-piece band. And, so I couldn't believe it. And I thought, this is unbelievable. And so that's what started it, you know, and then we started playing, you know, I mean, I was playing high school in the gym, you know, like dance parties and stuff. And with older guys that went to high school, you know, and but I would, you know, my mom would drop me off with my drums, you know, and I'd unload, and somebody, my older sister or my older brother, would pick me up at midnight or whatever, you know, after the gig. Yeah.
Wow. Now, do you remember when you realized that a career in music was truly going to be in the cards for you? Was there a moment?
I don't think there was a moment when I thought I've always thought I'm gonna do this. So I never thought like I'll be a big time producer or I'll be an engineer or I'll be a this or I'll be a that. I was a drummer. I sang. I was in a band. I was in all kinds of bands. I wrote songs. I thought whatever I got to do, I want to do this. And if I can make $30 or $40, and I can, you know, buy food. I can do this. You know, I had dreams, of course. Hopefully, you know, one day
Sure.
I'll play the Hollywood Bowl, or one day I'll be in a band and hear my song on the radio or something. But I never. It wasn't ever really like a choice. And I, unfortunately, I had parents that never said to me like, you know, once you get done with this high school stuff, you better start getting real about getting a real job, or they never kind of squashed my dream. You know, they never did that. They just were always like, hey, maybe it'll happen, you know. And I got a scholarship to go to Berklee School of Music in Boston. And I mean, I played sports growing up, and I was you know, the captain of my varsity football team and basketball team and baseball team. And I had
Wow.
offers to go to play sports and in college, and that's what I wanted to do. And I knew I would never like go to the next step after that. I was too small, you know. But I definitely had wanted to play football in college, and I got scholarships, and I visited some schools, and they would always say to me, they'd say, "Well, we'll get you in a communications program or some sort of program for your major, because you'll be playing football. You'll be coming here on a free ride to play football, you know." And I'd say, "Well, I want to play music. Do you have an orchestra? Do you have a..." And they go, "Well, that's too time consuming. You know, you're going to be here to play football." And I thought, "I'm also going to get an education, right?" And they were like, it seemed like the coaching people were like, "No, you know, we're going to be, you know, spring football. We'll be doing, you know, all kinds of stuff." And so I thought, "Man, I really want to continue my education in music, you know, and learn and play." And so when I got a little offer to go to Berklee, I thought maybe that's time to just, you know, move past, you know, the football thing, the dream of playing sports, and just get right to the music. And you know, they didn't have a football program, so I just went to Boston and brought my drums with me and started, you know, on this journey.
I was reading a little bit about your early years playing in the high school garage bands and high school orchestra and such. And when I saw the Berklee College of Music, I thought, oh man, that's kind of cool. And then I found out a friend of mine, Nick Coco, also attended Berklee. And so he was kind of excited to hear that you had attended as well. But following that period, you began working with blues guitarist Roy Buchanan. How did that gig present itself to you? And talk about the relationship that you built with him.
Yeah, you know, yeah, he's just was a wonderful guitar. I mean, one of the greatest guitar players I've ever seen. But that just started with I was actually playing when I got to Berklee. I immediately looked in the want ads for musicians looking for, you know, bands looking for, you know, a drummer, you know,
Yeah.
and I immediately got gigs. So I was just playing, and then one of the things, this one guy saw me play somewhere and said, "I'm the band leader for Roy Buchanan. You ever heard of him?" And I was like, "Of course." You know, my older brother had turned me on to Roy Buchanan. You know, he had all the records,
Right, right.
and I'd seen Roy. I went to see a couple of concerts with Roy Buchanan, and he said, "You know, the tour starts, you know." And I was like, "Boy, I'm in college, you know, I got classes, but I still wanted to pursue it." So I said, "Yeah, I'm around to audition or whatever." And never really thinking I'd get the gig, but it ended up he just said, "You're the guy." And I said, "Well, when am I going to meet Roy?" They said, "Well, you're going to meet Roy on the first gig," which was at a place called Jonathan Swift's in Boston. Two shows sold out one night, like a 7 o'clock early show and a late show. And
Okay.
so I that week I told my professors, I said, "Listen, I'm gonna be gone for a little bit. Is that gonna mess things up?" And they said, "No, you gotta be here. You gotta be here." And I said, "Well, I got this gig, And they go, "You got a gig?" I go, "Yeah, I got this gig with Roy Buchanan." And so most the professors were very cool. They, because a lot of it I found out later, these were all older guys to me, but they wanted to be professional musicians. But they ended up being teachers or wanting to teach, but they all played and they were very supportive too. They said, "Oh my gosh, how long is it?" I said, "I think it's going to be like 3 or 4 weeks and I'll be back." And they said, "Okay, just go and we'll make it up when you get back." So I went on tour and then,
Man.
and then that turned into more dates and more dates. And
Sure.
if you're asking me about my relationship with Roy, I ended up playing with him until his final gig. That he died that week, and I played with him
Wow.
in Guilford, Connecticut on his last show. And so, and he was an amazing musician, and people should who don't know who he is should obviously discover him, go buy his records and look him up. There's a great documentary about his I'm in it because it's he had a very the way he died, you might know, but it was there was a lot of crazy things about it. He died in jail. They said he hung himself. And there's a lot of people that don't believe that he did that. Well, I'm one of them. And the story's more intense,
Yeah.
but just on the on, he was fantastic. I learned a lot from him, and he was just an amazing player.
Wow. I have to skip around a little bit here because if I cover everything, we're going to be here all
Yeah, and
night.
I
So
just
I'm
shut me up if I start babbling about
no, no,
something.
no. I'm loving the stories and thank you for sharing that. I'll have to look up that documentary on Roy. And I do have a lot of his music in my library, by the way. In 1988, your band TH and the Wreckage released Born to Rock, and that was one of several self-produced works. But this album was responsible for the first of many of your Boston Music Awards, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. That's right. That's right. Yeah, it was, I guess the first time I ever went in with my band and produced and wrote. It was all original songs and we went in and did it. And Boston had such an amazing music scene. It still does, but it back then it was, Boston, the band Boston and Aerosmith and Extreme and the Neighborhoods and I don't know, just tons of bands. And so there was such a scene there in clubs with original music, and so we were very fortunate. We put that record out and the local big rock station WBCN would play some local bands, and because they were the band, they were the station that broke the Cars and they broke a lot of these bands.
Wow.
They were local, so they would play
Yeah.
us. And so anyways, that was a wonderful experience to win the Boston Music Award.
No kidding. Tom, I was reading as I was looking through your list of accolades and albums that you had produced. I stopped when I saw the album by Johnny Winters, I'm a Bluesman, and you received a Grammy nomination for that one. How did you meet Johnny and how did that come about, man?
Well, that's another thing. My older brother turned me on to Johnny Winter. My older brother
Okay.
probably is responsible for,
Got a good brother, man.
he had an amazing record collection, and he would go to concerts and come back late at night, and we shared a room, and I'd say, "What would," and he goes, "Oh, I saw Johnny Winter and Edgar Winter together." It was crazy, and he'd
Wow.
tell me about it. So when I was old enough to get out and see concerts, I went to see Johnny Winter many times, and I had his Johnny Winter and Live record and Captured Live and oh, so many, Saints and Sinners. I had all these records still alive and well. And I was a big fan. And then I produced a record for Susan Tedeschi and I had written the songs and played drums on it. And his manager called me one day out of the blue, just found me and said, "Hey, Johnny Winter really is digging the song Rock Me Right, and you wrote it and played drums on it. He likes the sound of it and everything." And he said, he's thinking about having you come in and produce a song or maybe write a song for him, kind of in that format, you know? And I was blown away. I was like, what? Johnny
Yeah.
Winter. And I said, so, okay. And then, so anyways, he flew me out to Detroit. And I want to say at the Kalamazoo Theater and, Michigan. And Kalamazoo, Michigan, maybe? Is that where
Yep.
that is? And
Kalamazoo, Michigan. Yep.
yeah, and he put a chair on the side of the stage and I sat there and then I rode in the tour bus with him after the show to the next show. And I
Wow.
think I flew home from there and I was just mesmerized, hanging with this guy, this legend. And
Yeah.
so I went back home and I wrote a song called Lone Wolf. And he's from Texas and he just looked like, he was albino and his white hair. And I just went, the lone wolf, and I howl from town to town. I'm the lone wolf, And so I sent it to him and he goes, oh, I love it. Can you come out and record it? And so I went and produced the track. And then he asked me to do like three or four more on that record because he had a producer, Dick Sherman, who has been his longtime producer. And actually, I remember I called Dick Sherman when Johnny called me because I said, I don't really, I didn't even know Dick, but I said, I don't want to, and he goes, oh no, Johnny wants you to do that, and I'll do the rest of the record, whatever. So he was very cool, and Dick's a wonderful guy. And so I went to Connecticut at the Carriage House, I remember, legendary studio there, and I recorded with Johnny. We recorded like four or five songs for that record. Yeah. And I
Man.
gotta say, talk about the industry. And I remember when it came out on EMI or whatever, it was nominated for a Grammy, and I got my copy of it. It said, I wrote and produced these songs, and Dick Sherman produced these songs, and they were flipped. They were the opposite. So Lone Wolf
Oh, no.
wasn't, so people would like go. I remember in their reviews, they'd be like, "It's weird. It's like Tom Hammers, who does this rock and roll thing, is doing this, really traditional slow blues thing, and then Dick Sherman, who usually does that, is doing this crazy stuff and wrote these songs, And there's no way to stop that, once it's rolling, so."
Oh yeah.
But I just, another little tidbit of music stuff,
I, but I but I have to ask you, man, did you call your brother and tell him, give him the na 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 na? Did you tell him any of
I
that?
did. I did. I said, man, And yeah, I was able to do that a couple times with him. I know he came out to see me play with Roy Buchanan. We played
Oh,
at
man.
Niagara Falls, and my brother came out one night, and my brother had taken me to Niagara Falls Convention Center to see Roy Buchanan with the Doobie Brothers when I was like, 8 years old or something. And
Right
so I
on.
was able to put him in a guest list and bring him backstage to meet
How
Roy
cool.
later
How
on.
cool.
And yeah, a couple situations like that, where I was able to
Yeah.
turn that.
Now, I'm going to skip ahead again because a big part of the body of your work has. Your defining work, I should say, is that which you created with the legendary Buddy Guy, both as a songwriter and as a producer. Sony reached out to you wanting you to produce for Buddy. How did you approach that opportunity?
Boy, yeah, I remember I was writing a song in Nashville with Jamie Johnson, I remember, and my phone rang and I said, this is like, looks like RCA or Sony Records or something. And I just stepped outside and took it, and I remember they brought it up, Buddy Guy. They said a lot of producers, are in the running for this, but what would you do? And I remember saying, I off the top of my head, I just said, I think I've seen him and he's so dangerous live. He's so, I'd love to capture some of that live energy in the studio. But also, I love what he does, Red House or Mustang Sally or whatever. But I'd rather hear him tell his story. Like, I'd like him to tell me about his life, because it seems like he's got this amazing life, but we don't know about it. And so Buddy ended up calling me later on and saying, I heard you wanted to do that, but how would we do that? You know, how would we write songs about? And I said, well, I'm a songwriter. So I would just have to, you'd have to just talk to me about your life, and then I'll try to put it into songs. And so that's what we did. I went up to Chicago to his Club Legends, and we hung out and drank cognac, and he would just talk to me about stuff. And I would write stuff down on a piece of paper, and I'd say, you know, just little things he'd say, you know, reminded me of, gave me ideas, you know, and
Sure.
where I would say, you know, where do you live, you know, and he'd say, I live out in the woods, man, you know, and I'd be out in the woods, you buddy lives in the woods, you know, and I'd just start writing it down, and then I rode on the tour bus with him, and he was funny because he'd be telling me a story, and I'd say, stop, stop. I gotta go get my pad and paper and write some of this down. I'll be right back, you know. And so then with the first record I did with him was called Skin Deep. And I mean, he asked me, he said, just out of the blue, he said, you know, I've always wanted to have a record called Skin Deep. And I said, well, I'll try to write a song called, I go, any information about that? He goes, no, my mama always used to tell me that beauty's only skin deep. I go, well, that's a famous line, beauty's only skin deep, you know. And so when I wrote the song, I wrote it with my friend Gary Nicholson. I went into the room writing, and we said, we can't write it about that. It's got to be, you know, beauty is only skin deep, of course. But I think, you know, skin deep, you know, underneath we're all the same. You know, we all have the same blood. You know, no matter what you look like, what color skin you got. You know, and so, anyways, I ended up just writing, you know, 10 or 11 songs, and after I spoke with him for a while, and I came back at him with these songs, and he listened to them, and he said, oh my gosh, I can't wait to record this record, you know. And I said, well, are you okay with these songs? I mean, are they? And he goes, no, it's everything I, you know, he related to him. You know, he said, I can't wait to sing these songs. I can't wait to sing Skin Deep. And, you know, show me the money, you know, because one of the songs, because he said, show me the money, man. I tell him, show. And I said, oh man, I got to write a really fun song called Show Me the Money, or every time I sing the blues. And so I would write these songs, and he would say, this is how I feel. And I go, well, that's because you kind of relayed that to me. And now it's a song, you know, with verses and melodies. So we kind of got this cool thing going. And then, you know, it was when Skin Deep was up for a Grammy, and we were in the, at the Grammys, and we ended up, we're leaving that night. He was getting into a limousine, and he looked over, and me and my wife were figuring out where we were going to go, you know, after the Grammys, what party or whatever, you know. And he said, hey, Tom, man, better start getting work, you know, start working on the next one. And I thought, you know, I thought, you know, I was just, this was living a dream. I'd done the record. I'd, you know, climbed the mountain. I was done. You know, I thought, whew, he's gone. He's just leaving. And we did it, you know, and wow. And it's amazing. And what an experience. And Chris, my wife goes, I think it sounds like he wants you to do another one. And I was like, what? And he goes, yeah, it sounds like he wants you to. And I was thinking, another one? How am I going to do that? You know, and so this, that turned into, I have the new record that just came out. You know, I produced the new record, Ain't Done with the Blues, and that's, I think, the eighth or ninth record. You know, you have it. You
I
know?
got a signed copy right here that Lynn Orman brought me back from Chicago.
Oh,
So
fantastic! Say hi to Lynn for me. She's
I
one.
well, you just did. You just did.
Oh,
She was
good,
gonna
good.
have me ask you about Skin Deep, but you preempted it. You had the story, so it's wonderful. But Tom, over the course of the next 10 years of working with Buddy, you contributed what, five albums, and you got three Grammys.
Like I say, I think it's seven or eight albums, I think. But I mean, yeah, multiple Grammys, it's been a dream. I mean, it's been so wonderful. I mean, he's so amazing to work with, and he's such a legend. You know, I've got to travel the world with him, and do all these things, and go to the White House and whatever, you know. I mean, it's just
It's
been
amazing.
an amazing run, you know, and I'm so happy for him because these records have done so well for him, and he's won all these awards. So it's been a dream come true.
I wanted to ask you about the career-defining album, The Blues Is Alive and Well. On this album, you wrote 12 of the 14 cuts, but more than this, That album drew Buddy out to a place where he played like a man on a mission, and that was your work, was it not?
Well, it's my work to get him excited about it and capture it, you know? I think, I remember telling everybody, because when I wrote that song, The Blues Is Alive and Well, and they were like, well, what's the concept of the record? I go, well, as long as Buddy Guy's around, the blues is alive and well. You know what I
Yes,
mean? So the
sir.
song is kind of saying, I'm going to stay around, I'm going to give it all my God, and the blues is alive and well, and I'm going to keep the blues alive. I'm going to pass the torch or whatever I got to do. And so he was definitely, he always delivers on the records. Everything I ask him to do, he always shows up ready and ready to give it, ready to take direction, ready to do whatever. It's amazing. Like, some artists are not like that. And after him doing so many things in his life, and
Oh yeah.
he could just show up and go, yeah, just whatever, I want to get out of here. He's not like that. He is, I'll do it again. If you're not right, looks like you're not totally, convinced on that. I go, okay, can you just give me another one and maybe play it a little this like this, and he'll, he's like, he's got the energy of a young artist, that wants to prove himself. And he's like that on stage every night.
Yes, he is.
He goes out to give it all, and so I asked him about that one time, and he said, well, a lot of the people that are out there have never seen me. And now I'm 80 something. I'm way past, I guess, what would be your prime, So he says, I have to go out and make sure, because it might be the last time or the only time they're going to see me. And I want to give it, 2,000%. So that's something that young artists could learn from, and I was out there on stage playing drums for him, thinking, we've just done, 4 nights in a row in 4 different cities, and he's tired, and I know he's tired, and we are all tired. And when he hits the stage, he gives it 100%. And some guys are, some artists, might be thinking, okay, well, we're in Iowa tonight, and we have to fly in the morning to New York City, and all the press is going to be in New York City at the Beacon. So let's just get this one done. I won't sing too hard, so I have my voice to, He's not thinking about that. He's thinking, this audience tonight in Iowa, I'm going to slam.
There you go.
And that's the beauty of him,
And he does. And when I got to see him the first time, it was during his Damn Right Farewell tour. It's the first time I'd ever seen him play. And one of the things I remember him saying from stage that night is, "It don't matter if you like me, I love you." And every time that I've seen video of him or heard recordings of him, he's always brought that to the stage. He's always brought that passion to the stage. And I was reading an interview by Blues Blast Magazine's Dan Wilcox. Speaking of your incredible success with Buddy, he said the following: "I know Buddy Guy. I wrote his biography, and I can't imagine any producer pulling this off." And he was speaking about the work you had been doing with him. And yet you did. You reinvigorated Buddy Guy late in life. To what do you attribute your massive successes with his music through the years? Because you've done a lot.
That's wonderful when somebody says that. I don't know. I think every time I work with an artist, I always tell them, I'm kind of a stickler for the songs. I'm a stickler for the I want I tell them I and they say, why are you so particular about this? You want to make sure that it's right, and you keep going over the mixes and yada yada. I go, I want to make the best record you've ever made. That's my, because my name's on it, and I want to produce the greatest record you ever made. And you've made some great records, and but that's where I'm putting the bar up, And so I think when I got the gig with Buddy doing Skin Deep, I thought, oh my gosh, this is a legendary guy who's done so many records, and
Right.
so I have to knock this out of the park, and I can't, I have to like spend all night working on songs and making sure I get it right, and making sure that the songs make sense for him and his audience to hear, And so I'm kind of like that about all the records, but I think with Buddy, I had the utmost respect for him, and I wanted to make sure that I didn't let him down. And I think what ended up happening was after the first record and the second record and the third record, he would just go, let me know when you got some the idea, the concept, songs, whatever. Let me know because we'll record a year from now or whatever, you know. And I didn't want to let him down. And so I would be, crazy over it. I gotta outdo the last record, and it won a Grammy and won all the awards. I gotta outdo it somehow. And I think I realized at one point someone said, he has so much trust in you, Tom. He just knows that you're not gonna, you're gonna give him your best. And I go, because I want his best. So I think it just turned into a kind of a unspoken thing where I could just, I knew I had one coming, and I would sweat it out. I'd be like, oh my gosh, I gotta do another one. I gotta follow up. The blues is alive and well. I gotta follow up this record. I gotta follow up Living Proof. And so I always had to like try to, think harder, write harder, play harder, and he was right there with me. He was like, yeah, well, let's do it. And so, knock on wood, it's been wonderful. And this record took me, about a year and a half to finagle to get it done. And I mean, I really had to, I even got off the road to do it. I said, I gotta just be in the studio every day, just tweaking this thing. And so I'm just glad that the world has, they love these records, and they've become fans. And some that were maybe had never heard them or whatever, and he's a buddy guy, he deserves it.
Very cool, very cool. Now, in 2013, I got to flip the page here. You produced James Cotton's last album, Cottonmouth Man. Take me inside that recording session, Tom, if you would. That album is such a cool collaborative effort. I was reading about that and reading the notes on it today in preparation. And I'd love to hear more about this.
Well, that was another thing, a labor of love. I mean, my brother had taken me to see him when I was young and had 100% Cotton records and all that stuff. And I was a big fan of his. And him and his wife, who managed her, reached out to me. And they said, they love the Buddy Guy records, and could I make a record for him? And I was honored to be asked. I said, yeah. They said the only thing is he can't sing anymore because he's got cancer in the throat. He can't, he can play harmonica still, but he can't sing. And so how would we do this? He has a singer in his band that goes out and sings when they tour. And I said, well, I think what I always say, the first thing is we need to write these songs. We need to have an album that is a concept for a vehicle for him, And they said, well, can he be involved in that? And I said, absolutely. I said, have him come to Nashville for a couple of days, and I'll sit with him, we'll talk, and we'll write songs together, right here. And so a lot of these people, these artists, Kingfish, all that, when I say that to them, they go, how are we gonna do that? And I go, well, just trust me. You just trust me, it'll work. And so he came to Nashville, and we wrote the whole record in like 3 days. And then I said to him, he said, well, how are we going to do this with the singer? Is my singer going to sing it? I said, well, we will probably have your singer sing a couple, but my idea is for I'm going to reach out to some other people that are probably fans of yours that might want to be involved in singing these songs. And he's, oh, I don't know. He can still talk. He just can't sing. He's, oh, man, that would be unbelievable. I don't know who, And I reached out to Warren Haynes, was the first guy I reached out to. I
Man.
reached out to Delbert McClinton. I reached out to Kebmo. Everybody I reached out to was for James. You're doing a James Cotton record? I'm in. What do you want me to sing? And I sent the songs, I mean, I even reached out to Greg Allman, and it was like he's not gonna, he loves James, but he's not gonna do it and everything. And I said, well, can I just send him? I was talking to his manager. I said, can I just send him a song? And he goes, well, I'm telling you, it's a lost cause, And I thought, I just had this one song called Midnight Train. I thought Greg would be great on it, but I totally understand if he doesn't want to do it. And I sent it, and I had done the whole, pretty much the whole record with all the guests. I had Ruthie Foster sing a song. I had all these wonderful artists came, and James was emotional about it. He couldn't believe it that all these people. I said, James, you're a legend. Don't think this is, they all want to. And so anyways, right around, it was actually right around Christmas, I remember, like a couple days before Christmas, I got a phone call and I just picked it up, and it was Greg. He was like, "Hey, is this Tom Hamrich?" I'm like, "Yeah, who's this?" He's like, "This is Greg, man." And I said, "Greg."
Wow.
He goes, "I'm listening to this song, And he goes, "I love it. How do we do this?" I'm in wherever he was, North Carolina or South Carolina. And I said, "Well, I can come to you, or you come to me." He goes, "Can you come to me?" And I said, "Yeah." So I went down there, went to the studio, and we cut Midnight Train. Unbelievable. And but yeah, so, and that ended up getting nominated for a Grammy, like you say. And we went to the Grammys, and I remember sitting with James, and it didn't win. Another record won our category, Album of the Year, Traditional Blues Album of the Year. And I remember he got so emotional, and we had to leave. We had to go outside for a minute. And I said, he was in a wheelchair, and I said, James. He goes, "I can't believe this is like my masterpiece. This was the greatest thing I've ever done." And I said, "It still is. Or if you feel that way, it still is. It's not, this doesn't define it. There's five or six albums in this category, and every one of them believe their record should win or whatever. It doesn't change how great you sound on this and how amazing job you did with these songs and all these people that love you that came out. It's still, and he got it, he, but it was like for a minute, it was like the end of the world. He was so distraught, and I remember going, this is, we're here, we're at the Grammys. How many people make records every year? How many records have you made in your life that have been fantastic, and you were here tonight, and yours is up on the screen, and it was very cool. He just loved it so much. And anyways, I'm really proud of him, and that happened before he passed on, so he got to be there.
I think the most difficult part of that album was listening to the last track when he
Bonnie
spoke.
Blue.
Yeah,
Yeah.
Bonnie Blue.
And that's amazing you brought that up, because I did say to him, he said, "Who's going to sing Bonnie Blue?" And I said, "You are." And he said, "I can't sing." I go, "Yes, you can. You can sing this one." And because Bonnie Blue was the name of the slave plantation that he grew up on, that he's a little kid on. And I said, "It's going to be at the end of the record. And I have a friend of mine named Colin Linden who's going to come in with guitar. It's just going to be guitar, harmonica, and you. And no one else but," he goes, "I don't want anybody to watch me because I can't sing." I go, It's just gonna be us." And I said, It's just trust me, just trust me. It's gonna be a good day." And he came in and he was nervous, but he started saying those lyrics and it was so emotional. "Bonnie Blue, I grew up on a farm." He just started doing it. And to me, I get chills thinking about it. I get chills when I hear it. Yeah, it was such a beautiful thing. And he was such a great singer. I mean, he was an amazing singer. And to lose that, I can't imagine, but he delivered it. And it was fantastic. And it was a beautiful time for me and James. And it's very cool. I got to introduce him to, well, not introduce him, but I mean, I think this is kind of common knowledge or whatever, but James Cotton and Buddy in Chicago, at some point they there was friction, they didn't hang out. And so James would call me and say, "Hey man, you're coming to town," I would be on the road with Buddy. "We're coming to," because he lived in Austin. He said, "You coming to Austin? I'd love to say hi to Buddy, And I remember always saying to Buddy, "Hey, James Cotton, I got him on the guest list. He might come down. He wants to say hello." And he's like, "Oh, okay." And I'd go up, and then James's manager would come to me. I mean, Buddy Guy's manager would say, "Hey, Buddy doesn't want to see anybody tonight in the dressing room." I go, "Hey, well, James Cotton's here, He goes, "He just doesn't want to see anybody." And so I went in. I went into Buddy's dressing room. I said, "Hey, man, I know you said you don't want to see anybody. Is there something with you and James?" He goes, "Yeah." He goes, "I just, it's long ago. I just don't want I go, I don't know what it was or what. I said, but he's out here in a wheelchair and he just wants to have a quick high with you. And I don't know what the beef is or whatever. And he goes, he's out there in a wheelchair? I go, yeah. I go, I can just wheel him in for a second, And he goes, oh, yeah, hell yeah, bring him in. And so I bring him in, and there's this couch backstage at Austin City Limits, Austin, ACL there. And I'm sitting there, and James is there, and Buddy, and they start catching up on the most amazing stuff. I wish I was recording it. They're like, remember that time, man? You were like, well, I never thought you wanted to do that. And they were like catching up on all this stuff. And it was unbelievable how they went right. They were so, they had done so many things together, and this the history which was going on, that finally, so I go, listen, the manager comes in, he goes, Buddy's got to get ready to go on, he got, and so I took a picture, and there's a picture of the three of us, and then Buddy goes, James, you bring your harmonicas? And he goes, I always got them on me, Buddy. He goes, I got to get you up, man. He goes, we're gonna do the real shit tonight. And so that night, he calls James up, and for like 30 or 40 minutes, it's insane. It's like Buddy just slows it down and goes, we're gonna, Austin, you're gonna see something that hasn't been done in a long time. And he goes, we're gonna get down, and me and James, and James is playing harmony. He goes, James, play a little like that's right. And they're playing against each other, and they were just doing stuff that was, it was out of this world. And that was a moment that I always remember, like going, this is the way it's supposed to be,
Yes, sir.
and just to, you know how it is. You probably have someone too. You haven't seen in a long time, or you whatever it was things went this way. I don't know, but these are two icons, and they've created so much music, and they lived in Chicago. It was great. Yeah, so that was pretty
Man.
cool. Yeah.
I gotta flip the, and thank you for sharing that story. That's incredible. That's the reason I do this program right here, collecting those stories, man.
Right
But
on.
I would love to hear about your Nola Sessions album, man. As I've read, you're far more daring with your own work than you are working with others. And as you explained, it's because your name's on it for them. But talk about the process of this album, if you would.
Well, I was a dear friend of mine, John Heidhouse. We had a label together, like a little label that we would put records out on, and he was always saying, "I want to do a Tom Hamridge record, your next Tom Hamridge record." And I'd say, "Okay, we'll do that." And I would, kind of put it in the back of my mind, and then all of a sudden he'd call me, and he'd say, "When are we gonna do that record?" And I said, "Well, we'll do it real soon." He goes, "Well, last time I asked you was a year ago, and since then you've produced five records, two that have been Grammys, this, and you're working on two others right now on another Buddy Guy record." And he goes, "So how?" I go, "Oh my gosh, really?" I said, "Well," he goes, "how are we going to do this? You got to make time to make your own record." And I said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, when I'm in Nashville, everyone comes to me. Buddy comes to me, James Scott, everyone. We make the records here." I said, "So if I'm in town and I schedule a record for me, and then, whoever, Kingfish goes, hey, I've got a break on that week. Can we get together and work on my next record?" I'll be, all right, let's just do it, because he only has that break. I can reschedule some other time, right? I can always move my thing. And so I never do my thing. I said, so I told him honestly, I said, the only way I'd be able to do it is if we went somewhere else and I had to go there and be there. And I wasn't in Nashville, I wasn't available for anyone else. And he said, where? And I said, well, maybe New Orleans. I always wanted to do a record in New Orleans. So he goes, well, I'm going to book it. We're going to book a week and go there. And I really, I'm kind of really, I like being under pressure. Like, so even when I say like to, when I say, yeah, Kingfish, come on over here and we'll write songs for the record, And he's like, well,
Right.
how are we going to do that in one day? I'll go, don't worry about it. And we'll write eight songs, I'm just ready. I'm like charged up with ideas, and I'll prepare the night before. I'll stay up all night because I know I'll half write songs, just to have them ready. And so I said to John, I said, I'll just write the songs when we go to New Orleans. He goes, but we're going to go to New Orleans to record the songs. I go, I know, but I'll be down there with the beignets and all them food jambalaya, and
Yeah, man.
I'll write songs down there. And then he said, who do you want to bring down to play on it? And I said, I want to play with people I've never played with, you know, and in a studio I've never been to. Just keep it fresh, you know, just, you know. And so that was what was exciting about that record. So we called in Sonny Landreth and all these amazing players, you know, all New Orleans cats that are so great. And the horn sections were like street horn section guys, and
Oh,
just
man.
it was just great. And I just wrote a bunch of songs down there. And we got Alan Toussaint to come in and sing a duet with me on and
Wow.
even when I was down, you know, Ivan Neville played keyboards on the record. All these guys. And so I would say, even when they'd say, "What do you want to eat for lunch?" I'd say, "Well, ask those guys, you know, where to eat." You know what I mean? Because they're local. You know,
Yeah.
I don't want to say what I want. Just I want to eat what they eat. I want to drink what they drink, and let's hang out. And so it was wonderful. And Alan Toussaint was the thing, because it was his last recording before he passed away, and it's a song called "The Blues Has Been Mighty Good to Me," and I wrote it with my friend Richard Fleming, and even the guys in the studio said, "You want to call Alan Toussaint? He's not going to come out. And, you know, he doesn't just come out for anybody, you know." And I go, and I thought, he probably doesn't know me, you know. And I said,
It's
"Well,
another
can't
Greg
hurt."
Allman story.
Yeah, I know. I go, "Yeah, right." I go, "It can't hurt to call him, you know." And I called him, and he said, "You want me to do what? Sing on, play on?" He goes, "Well, what's the song like?" And I go, "Well, it's called Blues. It's been mighty good to me." And it goes like this, and I sang it to him over the phone. And he went, "Yeah." He goes, "Where are you at?" And I told him the studio, and he goes, "All right, tell my son, who's my driver, whatever, how to get there, whatever, and what time you need me." And he showed up. And I remember that he showed up the next day, and I had an upright bass player there, and I was playing drums,
Oh,
and we had
man.
grand piano. And I remember the bass player and the engineer and the assistant engineer were like, "Well, what are we doing today? It's always different. You got different guys in here doing something. What are we doing?" I go, "Well, we got to set up, make sure that piano's in tune and everything. We got Alan Toussaint coming in." And they're like, "Yeah, right. No, really, what are we doing today?" And I said, "No, really. You know, he's supposed to. I don't know. Maybe he blows everybody up. I don't know, you know." And he walked in, man. He walked in, and
How cool.
unbelievable. Yeah, so it was great.
You
So I
know,
love that record. Yeah, I hope people that listen to this can check that record out.
indeed. You mentioned Chris Stone a minute ago, and I wanted to ask you because I've seen some of the work you've done with Kingfish and also with Jovan Webb, who just
Oh,
blew
yeah.
my mind from the
Awesome.
very first song. And I interviewed him early in my show. I think it was season one or early season two. And I'm dying for him to bring out a new album. I really am, because I enjoyed the last one, you know, so well. But looking at the talent that's out there today with Chris Stone and with Jovan and Matthias Lateen and oh my gosh, Young Rel, the young man Sean McDonald, Mac McDonald. Have you heard this kid?
Not enough, but I've heard of him.
When I heard the album, it reminded me of Sun Records Studio 1956. That's what I heard. Okay, that early Sun, you know, Sun
Oh, I love that
Studios.
stuff. Sure, yeah.
Yeah. And it's like looking at, you know, people are always worried about keeping the blues alive and this, that, and the other thing. I think the blues are in pretty damn good hands with the crew that's coming up, don't you?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, no, I mean, I saw Chris Stone a couple nights ago in Nashville. Here he came through town with a new record, and I'm so proud of the new record and proud of him. And it's funny you mentioned Jovan, because I'm working with him tomorrow on writing.
You tell him
On
Irv said hi from Time
I will. I
Signatures.
will. I definitely will. I definitely will.
We
Yeah, he's.
talk on Facebook occasionally, and I always tell him, man, go keep kicking it, man. Keep kicking it. You're doing good, you know?
He's got
And
an
he's,
amazing voice. He's got a lot to
oh.
say. And yeah, that first record, I mean, you know, it was "Bottom of the Bottle" and "Save Me" and "I'm a Drifter" and all those songs we wrote
Yeah.
right here. You know, we you know, so that's I'm starting the process of the next episode with him. You know.
I can't wait to see what you guys come up with. All right, we got to flip the page. Down the Hatch, it's your new album. And I think my favorite track on that album is Willie Dixon's Gone. Correct me if I'm wrong, but choosing that song to lead off the album was a hook by design. As in, this is a badass tune, so when you get the listener on the first track, they're in for the rest of the ride. Am I correct?
Yeah, I'm always thinking like that. I'm so old school to a lot of the young artists that I work with are like, what do you mean that's going to be the first song or that's going to be the last song? Like James Cotton knew when I was talking about Buddy Guy.
Yeah.
I'm just a record guy, you know. I mean, I grew up with, you know, these Sgt. Pepper started this way, or, you know, Sticky Fingers was this thing, or, you know, whatever record you want to name. You know, I knew the sequence and I knew how it lifted and it ended side one with this, and you had to flip it over. So, I'm like that all the time, and sometimes, you know, the young people are like, Tom, they're just going to have it on Spotify, and they're not. It's not going to be. I go, well, I'm making this record. And I want every detail to be right, so I want to have a good sequence. So I am thinking about that. I am thinking Willie Dixon's Gone is setting the stage.
Yes, sir.
It comes at you, kind of hits you in the face.
Yep.
Different kind of groove than you're used to. And
yes.
I'm telling the story about how it got inside of me, you know?
Yes.
And so if you want to come along with the journey, this is the start. And so I'm glad it worked. It worked to you.
Absolutely. You know? It absolutely worked. Trust me. Now, what's next for Tom Hambridge? You got any fun products in the mix for yourself currently?
Well, you know, I'm going to do some shows. I was talking
nice.
To actually Kingfish's manager, Rick, is always saying, man, I want to book you, because I do like cruises. I do maybe
sure.
10 or 15 shows a year with my band, the Rattlesnakes, I call them. And you know, when I was out with Buddy Guy, like I was playing drums for him on the farewell tour, you know?
Yep.
And I would open a lot of the shows. So I would do.
Yeah. You opened Kalamazoo.
Oh, I did. Okay. Yeah.
You did.
And so I would open a lot of the shows and people would buy my music and whatever. So, but I couldn't do anything else because I was on the Buddy Guy tour and play, you know, so if he was going to Brazil and Australia, I was in there, you know, so I couldn't book other shows for my band outside of the Buddy Guy thing. And so now that I'm home and I'm not doing that, I'm just making the records for people. I can go out and do some shows. I was going to say, cause Kingfish's manager, Rick, was like, he saw me on the cruise, the Joe Bonamassa cruise. And he's like, man, you should take this band on the road. You know, you got to do shows. And I go, well, I will when I get off the road, you know? So,
there's a song in that.
I know. Right. And I'll get out there when I'm off the road. So anyways, so I'm thinking of doing some of those things. And in the interim, you know, making a Jovan Webb record and doing another record for somebody else. And there's people that reach out to me a lot, you know. I mean, I'm always open, you know, and that's how sometimes a new artist like Kingfish, you know, came to me. I mean, nobody knew who he was, you know. I mean, he hadn't been in a studio before. So fortunately, and that was a Buddy Guy thing. Fortunately, Buddy Guy said to me, find this kid Kingfish and make a record for him, you know.
Wow.
And I'll finance it. He said, I'll finance it. So. And I said, well, how am I going to find him? He goes, well, you can find him and just find him. And I go, well, what do you mean? He goes, well, do it like you do to me. Write the songs and bring them in and record it like you record me, but do him. And so Buddy was very much responsible for that first record. It was a Grammy record and all that. And so.
Man.
Yeah. And so it was a beautiful thing. And so I'm doing that. And so people can, you know, I mean, you know, young artists can reach out to me. I'm not hard to find. It's not like I have a manager or I have, you know, I just want to make great records and,
yes, sir.
Keep the blues alive. And like I say, I mean, I don't call myself the big blues. I mean, I make records. I love all kinds of music and a lot of them, you know, win the blues awards and win blues Grammys, and that's great. But you know, if you listen to even a Buddy Guy, the latest Buddy Guy record, you know, you're going to hear all kinds of music on that record. You're going to hear gospel. You're going to hear, you listen to my record, you're going to hear stuff that sounds like maybe this is a Tom Petty kind of thing, or this is a, you know, crazy accordion sound on a record, you know, or I'll make a Buddy Guy record and have, him sing with Keith Urban, you know, or whatever, you know.
I mean, well, and it's funny that you say that you kind of the Tom Petty vibe, because I was sitting there listening to it again today, and I was getting that Tom Petty vibe.
Yeah.
So it's a nice eclectic mix. It really is.
Yeah, and it's funny because like I don't set out to write a song like Tom Petty or anything like that. I just write a song, but if I'm influenced by the Beatles and Tom Petty and Muddy Waters and
yes, sir,
and whoever, Santana and Stevie Ray Vaughan and Todd Rundgren, all this stuff's just going to be in what I'm creating. It just is. And so when I play a song for, you know, I don't know, It's the Hawk or whatever for Joven, you know, sometimes someone like, what are you talking about? I go, well, I don't know, man, but it's I'm feeling this thing. It might sounds like the Allman Brothers. I go, well, maybe I love the Allman Brothers, you know, you know, so, but it's not, I'm not taking one of their songs and it's not that, it's a fresh,
right,
brand new song, but it might have influences. You know, you might hear, it's the same thing how when like, you know, everybody that has a song on some record that they go, that's kind of Beatlesque, isn't it? You know, and that's because the Beatles did so many things. They did Eleanor Rigby,
yeah,
they did Helter Skelter, they did Come Together, they did all this stuff. So at some point you're gonna probably write something that has some sort of something that rings true from all the stuff they did, you know,
yep.
If you got your ears open, you know. Yeah.
Tom,
so,
here's
yeah.
the most, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. No, it's all good. I'm done.
I just got to say, here's the most important part of the interview, man. Where can people go to learn more about you, your massive body of work, maybe buy some CDs, especially the new one. Got to get the new one,
right.
Or some merch, or book you for a gig.
Well, I would say, my website, which is tomhambridge.com or Hambridge Tunes, or just Google Tom Hambridge and you'll see my website. I have a website. And
yes,
I
sir.
think there's a spot on the website where you can obviously order the new record, and it's actually on vinyl. I should have one, shouldn't I? But I have all kinds of records for everybody. And I'll sign it for them, and I would love that. And they have CDs and all kinds of stuff on there. And you can email me on the website.
Okay.
It goes to an assistant who sends it to me, but so it's not my personal email, but it's but he sends it to me, and so sometimes it's you know, hey, this is Tommy Castro, where the hell are you, you know, and I get it, you know, because, you know, and I go, oh, Tommy, man, you want to make a record, oh, we'll do it, you know. But so you can reach out to me that way, or but I love when people go to, I think I have a YouTube channel, you can watch videos, and Spotify. You know, all my records are on Spotify. You can listen to my music there if you don't like buying it. but yeah, you can always go to my website and find me, you know.
Sounds
oh, I have
good.
Instagram too. I'm supposed to say that. I have Instagram and Facebook, obviously.
We will put the full complement of links up on the information section. I promise you we'll do that for you.
Thank you.
But Tom Hambridge, I want you to know how much I appreciate you taking time for me today on Time Signatures. I wish you much continued success, and anytime you need a microphone to get word out of a new album or tour, just give me a call. We got a microphone for you, man. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Jim. It's a pleasure.
And that wraps up this edition of Time Signatures. Once again, my thanks to our guest, Tom Hambridge, but also to you, for without you, none of this would be possible. Jim Irvin reminding you, keeping the blues alive is everyone's responsibility, but preserving the history of the blues one story at a time is my mission. Until next time, so long, everybody.
This has been Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. For more information on CABS, visit capitalareablues.org. You can find this episode and past episodes at lccconnect.org. The Time Signatures theme song, Michigan Roads, is used by permission and was written by Root Doctor, featuring Freddie Cunningham.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up and down these Michigan roads, yeah.
Until next time, keep on keeping the blues alive.